Hello and welcome to another episode of The Thing About Cars. For those of you who have rated us online, Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, we really appreciate that. I've been reading some of the reviews. Some of you are leaving us five-star reviews, and I really, really appreciate that. That does a lot towards getting us on Apple Podcasts headlines, and hopefully one day they will actually feature us as a podcast. Around the table, our gang includes Dawn. Hello, Dawn.
Hello.
And Dave. Dave, how are you doing?
I am doing well, thanks. I'm a little intrigued by that seductive hello from Dawn.
Should we ask her to do that again?
No. I don't want to be sent to the Thing About Cars HR.
And our special guest for the day, Jim Weed. Jim, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. Before we get into it with Jim, I wanted to ask a couple of trivia questions. Jim, what is your official title? Do you have a title? Because we met you at Italian Car Day 2020.
My official title is editor of the Ferrari Market Letter.
Ah, okay.
So I'm a part owner and editor.
Okay. Got it.
I've just been calling you Ferrari Czar.
I am that also.
All right. So before we dig into that any harder, let's have our grand trivia auto moment of the day. I have two Ferrari-oriented trivia questions. The first one is, what was the last Ferrari automobile that was personally approved by Enzo Ferrari? Was it the 333 SP, the 288 GTO, the F40, Ferrari F40, or the Ferrari 412 T1? One of those was the last thing he signed off on. You need me to read those again, anybody?
Actually, wrote them down.
You did?
Okay, yes, cool. I did.
All right. So the second Ferrari trivia question for the day is, what was the original sales price of a new Ferrari 250 GTO in the United States? And our choices are $18,000, $1,800, $8,000, or $80,000. One of those is the correct price tag for the original sales price of a new Ferrari 250 GTO in the U.S. We will answer those questions at the end of the episode. Let's turn our attention to Jim. Jim, so glad you could join us at the table today. And, you know, when we met you at the Italian Car Day 2020, it was actually Ben's suggestion that you come on the show, and I'm glad you could join us. Unfortunately, Ben is a little predisposed this weekend. He won't be able to join us, but I'm hoping we can have a good time and maybe make a little fun of Ben in his absence.
So well, I'm glad to be here. I actually ran into Ben accidentally. I saw you guys out doing your show, had no knowledge of it, and talked to you guys in the parking lot. I happened to be carrying a bunch of the Ferrari Market Letter magazines with me and handed that out. And I'm glad that you guys have asked me to come on the show.
Yeah. I have to ask my silly, stupid questions are, why Ferraris? Has it always been Ferraris? Have they always just been a passion for you? How did you luck into it? And how did you start the magazine? Let's start talking about those things.
I got into Ferraris back in 1977 when I got hired at the Ferrari dealer in Tucker, FAF Motor Cars. Oh. I'd actually been towing cars for them for a couple of years previous to that. I had a friend who had gotten hired kind of right when the company had gotten started. And so I had a van in 1977. That was an old hippie van. And they had a trailer, and they needed Ferraris picked up from around the country. And I did that for a couple of years and thought, this is a pretty neat place. I was never into sports cars, had no real knowledge of Ferraris. But I got hired in the parts department. And the parts manager was Gerald Rausch. And Gerald Rausch is the fellow who actually started the Ferrari Market Letter. And so his goal was to collect serial numbers, collect history, owners, colors, mileage, that kind of information. And so the Market Letter became a method of being able to advertise Ferraris for sale and gather owner information of the people who were advertising the cars. So our database has been collecting history on Ferraris since early 70s. And so I worked with Gerald. He left FAF and then started the Market Letter full time. And so the Ferrari Market Letter has been in continuous publication every 2 weeks, 26 issues a year since 1976.
My goodness.
Wow.
Cool. Very cool.
Wow.
I went on to have, I sold parts here. I went to California, sold parts. I came back to Atlanta and was service manager at FAF. Did that for 6 years and then opened my own shop. And I did that for another 15 years. I sold it and I was at an event and Gerald corralled me and said, come work for me. So I came and worked for the Ferrari Market Letter. And about 10 years ago, Gerald passed away and his daughter and I got together and we bought it from her mother. And we've now owned the Ferrari Market Letter for about the last 6 years.
Very cool.
Wow.
Man, how, I mean, how big is the Ferrari market overall?
In terms of dollars, I don't know. I can't even tell you. It's, you know, Ferrari makes $2 billion a year selling new cars. Obviously the used car market is very lucrative and a lot of the older Ferraris are very valuable. You'd mentioned your GTO and your trivia question, and GTOs have traded hands fairly recently, you know, somewhere in the range of $50 to $70 million. Oh. So that's kind of the top of the market. But the market goes all the way down to a 308 or a 348. And a lot of those cars trade hands for well under $100,000. So for $60,000 or $70,000, you can get into a Ferrari.
Hmm. So Jim, I'm curious, you're uniquely positioned through the publication to interact with a lot of different Ferrari owners and aficionados. Do you find there, apart from a love for the Ferrari, that there's some overarching characteristic or unique aspects to Ferrari lovers?
I think the owners run the entire gamut. I've got customers that are very down to earth, very down to earth, hold normal jobs, are not wealthy at all, but they love the brand. And I've got other customers that are way up in the rarefied atmosphere that have collections of, you know, 10, 20, 30 cars. So it the range is all over. There is a certain amount of love for the car that occurs. People get a friend of mine told me a story. He was into Corvettes and he would show up at a car event with his brand new Corvette. And in the parking lot, there would be a multitude of automobiles, kind of like your basic cars and coffee. He would show up and people would go, wow. And then an old 308, a Ferrari that's 10 years old, not near as technologically advanced as his Corvette, would show up and everybody would leave and go look at the Ferrari. And so it's kind of a feeling, and part of it is a lifestyle. People get wrapped up in it. And it's kind of exciting.
The interiors are stunning. Italians do an incredible job with the interior of that vehicle.
There was one Ferrari when we were at Italian Car Day that was a good bit nicer than my living room.
That's very common. And I have actually seen Ferraris in people's living rooms.
Wow.
Yes.
On the flip side, I don't know a delicate way to say this. Do people pimp Ferraris? Do you ever see somebody come up and say, oh, why the hell would you do that to that car?
Today, in today's environment, you do tend to see that, because today originality has become much more important. In the 70s, when I got started into Ferraris, people were, they painted the cars the color that they liked. they put interiors in the way that they liked. There were changes. Wheels, the cars got aftermarket wheels. The originality aspect was not as important as it is today. I have customers that'll call them. They'll say, oh, well, this car was restored in the 1980s. And I'm like, wait a minute. Today, we think of a restoration as being put on a rotisserie. The car is completely taken apart. Everything has been gone through. Every single part has been looked at, massaged, lovingly put back together. And this is now a perfect automobile. In the 1980s, a restoration was re-dye the interior and a paint job. So we have to always kind of put things into context of time and place.
Jim, is there a Ferrari in your garage right now?
There is not.
Oh, man.
Oh. Part of the downside of working in the business,
yeah,
is it makes it more difficult to afford a Ferrari.
Right.
I was in commercial aviation. It was the same thing. You know, the longer he worked in aviation, the harder it was to afford a 767.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Well, I had a Cessna 172 for about 20 years, and I used to tell people, well, I'm flying my Testarossa. But Testarossas have gotten a lot more expensive than 172s.
Well, Jim, I wanted to introduce you to my Ferrari. It's a cat, but he's somewhere hiding. So
Dawn has a unique naming convention for all of her furry companions.
We've had a Porsche and a Mercedes, and then now we have a Lamborghini, a Ferrari, and a Bentley.
I'm thinking about getting a hamster and naming it Civic.
Yeah, only high-end cats enter this house. So Ferrari was definitely up for this next round of feline friends.
Well, he knew what we were doing today, and he's probably in hiding.
He is probably, because I can't find him anywhere. So,
yep, I do see him in the spreadsheet reading the run of show every
day. He usually is here, so, you know. But right. Yeah, talk about affordable.
Jim, is there anything in particular you would like the rest of the world to know about Ferraris, and especially like the modern world of Ferraris? What is something that the average person like me would get a kick out of knowing about Ferraris?
I think the thing that most people, the misconception with Ferrari is they think that Ferrari is a very large company compared to the other automobile manufacturers, Mercedes, Ford, Honda. Ferrari is a very small company. Ferrari is one of the new automobile manufacturers. They were started in 1948, maybe 46, right after the war. Previous to the war, there were no Ferraris. Ferrari was involved in racing and was involved with Alfa and kind of ran the race team, but there were no technical Ferraris. So Ferrari, being such a small company, has always been frugal with manufacturing, with their race cars. Very few companies have done more in racing with as less that Ferrari has had.
That is interesting, Jim. Do they manufacture pretty much everything, or do they source like, you know, calipers and brakes and other things from other companies?
Ferrari basically manufactures the engines and the transmissions and the body is pretty much all done in house. Most of the normal things, taillights, accessories, those are all purchased outside. Most manufacturers only build, I don't know what the percentage is, but they build a small portion of the car. The rest of it is outsourced. Right. And Ferrari is always outsourced. The difference is that when we go, if we look back on like a 275 GTB, so early 60s, mid 60s Ferrari, their production schedule was so low. And if they needed taillights, instead of buying, oh, we're going to build 400 cars, so we need to buy 800 taillights for the 400 cars we're going to build, Ferrari would buy them 50 at a time. So they were buying 50 taillights for the next 25 cars. And in 2 months, we'll buy 50 more for the next 25 cars. So what you find over time is that the cars are all a little different. There is not a set standard. And Ferrari was always innovating. And I say innovating, it's more of evolution than it was revolution in their design. So as you look at their history, the cars slowly got better and better and better in terms of performance, quality of build, and things like that.
That's, you know, actually that's pretty advanced because it's right on time supply. I mean, that's in the supply chain. That's probably really smart.
It's good and bad. What happens today is you'll find a very original car, a barn find. Mm-hmm. And if you were to take that barn find to a Concours, people would pick it apart because those aren't the right taillights. Mm-hmm. The door gaps are not correct. Some detail in the interior is different. And what people have forgotten is that these cars were truly hand-built cars. They were built in very small runs, and there's a certain amount of individuality in each car. And we've lost a lot of that.
Oh, that's cool. That is.
I confess, I have something of a love-hate appreciation of Concours events. They tend to remove the appreciation of these fine cars away from the everyman. And I have a sort of a philosophical problem with that. On the other hand, there's some beautiful things to see at a Concours event that you can't see anywhere else. So, I don't know. Like I said, love-hate relationship.
I think it's fantastic that we get to see these cars in their glory. And I agree with you. I think that there are too many cars that are on the Concours and not enough that are being driven. I would prefer to see people drive their Ferrari as a service manager and being involved in fixing the cars. The car that gets used on a regular basis is always in much better shape than the car that sits around all the time. We advertise Ferraris for sale all the time, and it's a 10-year-old car. It's got 3,200 miles on it.
Oh, my God.
And you think, wow. You know, why? The basic answer to that is I don't want to put miles on it because it might devalue the car. And my point of view is, how much fun are you missing out on? And if you drive the car and enjoy it and you get a little less for it, so what?
Yeah.
Right. Had a lot of fun.
Totally exactly. Agree. Yeah.
I talked to a customer this week. He's got an F40. Now, an F40 is a fantastic supercar. He's got 31,000 miles on it. What's an F40 worth with 1,200 miles? A couple million, maybe. An F40 with 32,000 miles on it is probably worth 1.5. Mm-hmm. So what's the cost per mile, and how much fun has he had?
Yeah.
In 31,000 miles of driving that car.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. How many different styles come out? Like, does Ferrari try to keep 3 or 4 in production or limit what they're doing as they move through the years? Because, like you said, the F40 is probably, what, the late 80s, early 90s?
Correct. Right now, Ferrari is, and I'd have to think about the number off the top of my head, but they've got about 5 different platforms that they're working on. For being such a small company, Ferrari currently is building about 10,000 cars a year. That's a good week's production out of 2 Ford plants on a Monday through Friday. Yeah. But that's their yearly production, and they're building coupes and spiders, convertibles, in a high performance version and in a everyday performance version. If you want to think about it like that, the Portofino, is a, I always hesitate to say a common Ferrari, but the Portofino is really kind of designed as a lower performance, everyday car. Top goes up, top goes down. It's open air driving. The new Roma is going to be a mainstay product for them. But then you've got the F8 Tributo on the higher performance side for the V8, and then the 812 GTS or 812 Superfast, both of those versions as a higher performance V12. Well, and so they've got a high performance level and then a more of an everyday level.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that Porsche allows you to kind of customize your vehicle and maybe go pick it up in Germany, in Stuttgart. Can you do that with Ferrari? Can you say, hey, this is what I want in mine and I want to come get it?
Absolutely. and you will pay dearly for that privilege.
Okay.
I've seen sticker prices where the sticker price was actually less than the sum of all the options.
What? Interesting.
Wow.
Now, is it similar, like you have to drive it around Italy until you stick it on the boat?
Actually, one of the funny things, when I was at Delta, we had a specific air freight product to fly cars back from Germany and Rome, and because I was head of marketing and also customer claims, anytime we were flying a Ferrari, I had to be notified and personally sign off on the insurance policy.
Wow.
This also involved me calling everybody in the Rome airport and threatening them with death if they didn't, ding the car as they were loading in the plane.
Jim, I love this. We're out of time for this segment. I'm hoping you can come back and join us again so we can talk about the future of Ferrari and some of the things you might be hearing about. I know that the world is changing with the advent of electronic engines and stuff like that, but hopefully a part two with you is in our future.
I would love to come back and do it again.
So, Jim, our standard questions for all of our guests. Number one, what is your dream car?
My dream car is a 288 GTO.
Oh, okay.
Because it looks like a 308 on steroids, and they are incredibly quick.
Excellent. Right. Where is your next road trip?
Next road trip is to Celebration, Florida, the Exotic Car Festival and Celebration, which is coming up in a couple of weeks.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Right on. I didn't know that Celebration did an Exotic Car Fest.
They do. They didn't. Obviously, a lot of people didn't do things last year, but they do it every year. And the one after that is going to be Cavallino down in West Palm Beach.
Excellent. What's the most fascinating thing you've seen in someone's house or garage?
I've seen a replica of the entrance to Wrigley Park in a gentleman's garage, and he had, I don't know how many, probably 15 or 20 cars in this garage, which was absolutely spotless, but he had a replica of the front of Wrigley Field on one wall.
Ah,
wow.
Pretty impressive.
That is pretty impressive.
It's impressive.
My last question for you is always something whimsical and trivial in its own way. But if someone from the 1950s suddenly appeared in front of you, what would be the most difficult thing to explain to them about life today?
From the 1950s, that would have to be that you can take a plug from your garage and stick it into your car, and you don't have to ever visit a gas station.
That is true. That would probably shock somebody from the 50s. Thank you, Jim. And again, we'll certainly stay in touch. I hope you'll stick around for the rest of the episode so we can answer the trivia questions. And a quick note before we shift gears, now that I'm remembering this, before we do Dave's Cultural Collision, our friends have already announced the date for Italian Car Day Atlanta for 2021. John Montgomery sent us a note. He says, we're looking at doing Italian Car Day on Saturday, October 2 at the Ferrari Maserati store. So Saturday, October 2. Hopefully we can all be in attendance for that. I just thought I'd make an announcement real quick. But Dave, what have you got for Cultural Collision today?
You know, I think Since one of the standard questions you ask every guest is about a road trip, it got me thinking about road trips. You know, last week our trivia question was, what was the first cross USA road trip, the first one who made a trip across? And that was Horatio Nelson Jackson and Sewell Crocker traveled across country in 1903. And they were the first ones to drive across country.
Yep.
So I thought we would actually talk today about road trips. So I alluded to this a little bit last time with Horatio Nelson Jackson and Sewell Crocker. So on May 23rd, 1903, the two of them slid into the front seat of a cherry red Winton touring car and chugged down San Francisco's Market Street to try to drive across country. What I didn't tell you last week is they were doing this to try to, because Horatio Nelson Jackson had made a $50 bar bet that he could drive across country in 90 days, which, you know, it's many of my road trips have involved bar bets. So this intrigued me and drug me into the story. So they named the car the Vermont because Dr. Nelson was heading home to Burlington, Vermont, and he had 90 days to get across country. And this trip sounds like absolute hell on wheels, no pun intended. Well, actually, somewhat intended. And as he was driving across the country, you know, they've got like 15 miles outside San Francisco and Bulmatire, and they got 20 miles outside and Bulmatire. And so even though they were driving across country in this brand new piece of technology, they were absolutely dependent upon stagecoaches and railroads and horse and buggies to get them parts all the way across the country as things were breaking or falling off, and they were constantly having to replenish the Vermont. But they successfully achieved it. So the goal was to get to Manhattan, and Vermont arrived on Fifth Avenue at 4:30 a.m. on Sunday, July 26, 1903, after 63 days, 12 hours, and 30 minutes driving across the country. Dr. Nelson won the $50 bet, but the trip had cost him $8,000.
Holy mackerel.
In 1903 money. And again, you know, as I said, many of my road trips have involved a bet. They've also had a similar approach to finances and common sense.
So, yeah.
The thing about road trips is, yeah, road trips predate automobiles, but there is something about road trips that are uniquely American. I mean, you know, you could actually argue that all the way through history, there's been this road trip model. The Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer are technically road trips. and you guys know, I've written a couple of books. There is a specific genre of book called, in German, a Bilderroman, which is basically a road trip story. The trip is a metaphor for how the main character evolves and grows. And that story, that road trip, is kind of really unique in American culture. And we've talked about this before, you know, of our experiences driving in other countries in Europe, but especially after World War II, it became so embedded in our culture. I was doing some research on that. So to Jim's point on Ferrari being a post-World War II company, the automotive culture in the United States versus Europe were drastically different, because Europe had its whole infrastructure wiped out. Then that included car manufacturers and roads and gas stations. And so it wasn't as easy as just hop into a car and drive across Europe. In the States, our infrastructure wasn't wiped out. Mm-hmm. And so, and we had built all this manufacturing infrastructure. We turned it towards building cars and planes and refrigerators in the United States. But there are like three things that happened. You know, you had Route 66 giving way to the interstate system, the more ready access of cars and more disposable income. And Jack Kerouac wrote, you know, what was quintessentially the road trip book, on the road, and then later, Travels with Charlie. Steinbeck. Well, yeah, it's The Grapes of Wrath is a road trip story. a really bloody depressing road story.
Yeah. But it is a road trip story. So
and it runs all the way through. You've got like Rebel Without a Cause and even a mad world,
it's so true.
Private Idaho, Thelma and Louise, they're all road trips.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right. So I have two questions for you, Dave. Can I interrupt you and ask you two questions?
Absolutely, please.
The first one is, what is so archetypal about these road trips? I mean, isn't that the crux of what you're getting at?
Well, it is. I think, I think one of the reasons that they resonate so much with the American psyche is the American story is a Bill Dunn-Rollinsman, where that it is a continuous reinvention of oneself. And just like in a road trip, the trip stands in as a metaphor for the evolution the character's going through. America is a continuous work in progress. Yeah, much like the interstate system through Cincinnati, which is never, ever, ever complete.
So, in fact, I might have a third question here. You said that you've done road trips on bar bets. Can you talk about any of those?
So actually, one of the best road trips I took wound up with me in Bimini. It's really hard to drive to Bimini.
Yes.
But in college, it wasn't so much a bar bet as just we were trying to figure out what we were going to do for spring break. This is 1987.
Oh, okay.
And in the course of three pitchers of beer, we had, and this is before the internet, we had figured out and found a way to rent a sailboat, hire a captain from Fort Lauderdale the next weekend. And so literally we finished up finals and got into, and there's like seven of us going. Well, none of us, college cars. So, I had a Mustang. I could fit two people and a case of beer. And so it's like, had a seven car caravan down to Fort Lauderdale, where we got on to the sailboat that we had rented, a 44-foot Morgan named the Wraith Gracie. Met the captain who we had hired, who had never been on this boat before. And all I could tell you is this boat was the most evil, haunted vessel ever.
What? Wait a minute.
We set sail from Fort Lauderdale at like 10 o'clock at night. We almost capsized at like 2 o'clock in the morning. We got shipwrecked for a while on a key.
How did you make it back home in time for school?
Now, bear in mind, I'm an engineer. All of us were engineers. And so we almost got demasted at one point. We can fix this. I'm an aerospace engineer. If we wanted to get the boat airborne, I knew what I was doing.
That's crazy. Jeez. So, no, no pirating. You didn't put on a red shirt and an eye patch and go and do some marauding around the Caribbean.
The statute of limitations on pirating forbid me from answering that question.
oh my gosh.
That's too funny. All right. Well, anyway, sorry to interrupt you, Dave. Please.
Oh, no, I think that's it. Actually, yeah. I'll put the question back to the three of you. Do you all have any great road trip stories?
Jim?
I hauled a Fiat Dino from Atlanta to Cincinnati. And this car was supposed to be out on the street so I could just pick it up and go. It was at the bottom of a driveway and I had to use a come along 8 inches at a time to haul it to the top of the street so I could get it on the trailer. What I was supposed to leave at 6 o'clock at night. I didn't leave till 9 and it rained the entire trip. And I drove all night and drove an exit, maybe two, pulled off, took a nap, drove two more exits, pulled off, took a nap. It was raining cats and dogs the whole way. I have got the record for the greatest amount of time between Atlanta and Cincinnati to deliver this car. I don't even remember how many hours it was, but it was way too many.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Dawn, what about you?
Dave, while you were bimining it, I was same year. I bet you your spring break was like the first week of March.
Yep.
So that's when ours was, because it was always on my birthday, always on your birthday.
Yep.
And one of my best friends from college, we were juniors, and we same year, like I said, literally opposite sides. We decided everybody, you know, from Penn State goes to Fort Lauderdale or Daytona or Fort Myers. No, we were going to South Padre, Texas, South Padre Island. We were like, that's where the tall guys are from Minnesota. So we're going to South Padre, Texas. So we worked with a travel agent and we got all, you know, we'd saved up all fall, worked everything out and, you know, got on the plane, landed in Corpus Christi and said, we'd like a taxi to, this is our address for our hotel, blah, blah, blah. They're like, well, that's South Padre Island. We're like, yeah, that's where we're going. They're like, that's 3 hours away. She had thought she had booked us on North Padre.
Oops.
So I had to go to the car rental place, get Hertz or somebody. Well, I was going to be 21 on Wednesday. And rental cars were like, you got to be 25. Mm-hmm. I sweet talked that car into a Grand Am, a red Grand Am. Because once I got them to say, yes, they would rent me a car, then I started to choose which car I wanted. So I got this red Grand Am. And we, by about midnight, we pull into South Padre, Texas. You know, it was like a Friday night. We left after school, you know, like it's Friday. It's Friday at Penn State. Left midday, got down there. Finally, after all that stuff, pulled into this hotel that was so nasty. I couldn't even like go into the lobby and just said, no, we're canceling. And then we drove around South Padre Island till we found this place called the Oleander Inn that was acceptable to two girls. And luckily we could cancel our other, I think it was a Best Western. I don't know. It was nasty as can be. And then just, you know, stayed at a different place and had our little red Grand Am that we cruised up and down South Padre in. But the funniest thing is we met a bunch of very tall, blonde, blue-eyed guys from Minnesota.
Which was your original
goal, right?
Yes, that was the goal. And we achieved our goal. And so we hung out with them and they all wanted to go to they wanted to go to Mexico on my birthday day. And I was like, no way, I am not going to Mexico. It is going to be depressing. People are going to steal stuff. And I'm sorry, Mexicans, I know this is probably very, very not the way you want to be perceived. And I agree with you, but that was back in 1987. So I was very, very nervous about going to Mexico. So I had a passport and they didn't. I was the only one with a passport. Literally, I mean, I travel all over the world. I was the one with the passport. I was like, you guys go. I've been to other countries. This is my birthday. So on my birthday, after I drove up and down in my little cute Grand Am, I then parked it, walked across the street with my, I'm now 21 years old, bought me 6-pack of Corona, a bag of Fritos, and laid on the beach all day eating Fritos and drinking Corona on my 25th birthday by myself as the birds were trying to peck my eyes out. And then they all came back very disappointed that they had gone because it was very difficult, unfortunately. Yeah. So again, I apologize to our Mexican compadres, but they all came back and we celebrated my birthday and took that Grand Am and on Saturday and hightailed it back up to Corpus Christi, got on a plane and went back to Penn State.
Right. Oh man.
And that's the story and I'm sticking to it.
That's good. That's good stuff. I don't actually have, well, I mean, I have many memorable ones, but the only one that's really floating to the surface of my brain right now is a road trip I made with a friend after undergrad. We drove to Potosi, Missouri to see his then girlfriend. So it was this marathon drive up and it was like, I can't remember how many hours it was. It was like 12 to 14 hours of driving to go the way the heck out in the middle of nowhere in Missouri. The drive up was actually pretty cool. The drive back, however, was a major challenge because we left at something like 10 o'clock at night and we weren't going to stop until we got back to my house, which was at that time in McDonough. And it was just, we were so dead tired that my friend Steven, we were saying to each other on the way down that I'll drive for as long as I can and then it's your turn, right? And so we would drive for like a couple hours, maybe 90 minutes to a couple hours. And I would say, okay, Steven, I can't do this anymore. It's your turn. And I would crash in the passenger seat of his little MR2, lovely car, fascinating car. And he would drive for another 2 hours. He would tap me on the shoulder. He's like, okay, Mickey, it's your turn. I can't keep my eyes open. And luckily we didn't wipe out. We didn't fall asleep at the wheel. Luckily we made it home and crashed for like 12 hours, maybe even more. And then when I finally woke up, Steven just had left a note. He's like, I'm heading home, and his home is actually in Central Florida. So he had another good 7 or 8 hours of driving to do on top of that. But that kind of marathon driving was something to remember and not something I would ever advise anybody to do. So
especially to Potosi, Missouri, which is about halfway between Cape Girardeau and hell. And well, closer to hell.
I got to say, there's some beautiful countryside out there, but oh my goodness. Yeah. I wasn't quite ready for the experience of what it meant to be driving to the middle of nowhere. That was, it was still in the long run, I'll say it was a fun time, but, so let's switch gears. And thank you, Dave. Anything else for a cultural collision?
No, I think we've covered enough on that trip. Okay.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of worst car stories. I thought we would have a car question, but I want to save the questions we've got for when Ben's back at the table, because I think he would have fun with a couple of these. But,
and because the rest of us don't know what the hell that we're doing.
Well, I don't know. Should we discuss the question and put Ben to shame next time? I mean,
yeah, no, trust me. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. It's like, you know, I just go along and nod intelligently whatever Ben says.
Okay,
like,
right.
Oh, yeah, you can fix that with chocolate pudding. You're right. You can.
Ben is our note. He's the man. He's our subject matter expert.
Duct tape and a little WD-40, you're good.
The whole reason I have ever accomplished anything in my career is I know how to leverage my own ignorance. What do you think, Ben?
All right, so I've got two car stories. Please tell me if you've heard any of these before. I can't remember which one I've shared or which one I haven't. Elizabeth Parks talks about a 1986 Cadillac Cimarron. Have I shared that one already? Mm-hmm. So she says... her worst car story is that this 86 Cadillac Cimarron, which is, she says, is basically a Chevy with the caddy hood ornament. It was a fine car when my dad drove it. I got it in 1988 when a tree fell on the car when she left it at home while she was at law school. Eventually, the electric windows didn't work and the driver door wouldn't open, so she couldn't go through drive-through restaurants anymore. And that was the worst thing about that car. No more drive-through restaurants. And a Cadillac Cimarron, you know, small to mid-sized Cadillac for the 80s. I get it. Basically a Chevy with the caddy hood ornament, but it's not the only time the automotive world has taken an entry-level car and just rebadged it for luxury purposes.
Yep.
Like the Toyota Camry and the Lexus ES300 or something. It's the same car. Just one of them has leather.
Right.
So my friend Amy Steph Buckner says that her worst car ever was a Chrysler LeBaron convertible. She writes, "What a lemon. Seriously, I have too many stories to tell about that car." And for the record, I'm going to actually ask her to read these stories onto a recording for us, and we'll just insert them into the episode if we can get them from her. She says, "Seriously, I have too many stories to tell about that car. After the top was ripped open from a break-in, the car alarm speaker was cut, but the alarm wasn't disconnected properly. So all the lights would start randomly blinking while she was driving it. The fuel injectors were leaking one time and the engine was on fire, but I didn't know it because I was on the highway. When I finally pulled up to my apartment and parked, the entire thing burst into flames. In the end, I had to start it by turning the key a certain way while at the same time popping the hood." What? And she says, at least she has some laughs to look back on. And I know she's got more to share about this car, so I'm hoping we can get that from her and just insert it in there. But to start the car by turning the key a certain way while at the same time popping the hood is how do, what? How does that work? Is that like the old antenna on the TV where you have to just assume the right position so you can get
you get so desperate while trying to experiment and like, what happens if I press the accelerator and turn the radio on while turning the crank?
Right. Or if I stand outside the car and spin in a clockwise direction three times before sitting down and I cross myself before doing the key, and that's the only time it's going to work, right? So
yes, but let's think about this. So when you pop the hood, there is something that happens. I mean, you can feel the jerk. Maybe that's just what it jiggled the key enough to make it fit into the tumblers or something like that.
Well, the key to all of that is once you determine what it takes, whether it was good, bad, right, or wrong, that's the procedure you're going to follow from then on. So if it started once because she popped the hood, if you do that process every time after that, then it's going to work.
That's
You're also going to carry it on to subsequent cars you own. So, well, you know, I used to have this LeBaron. Try popping the hood while you're cranking it.
What I don't know, and what I'll have to ask Amy, is she says she didn't know her car was on fire until she got home. Well, then what happened? Because clearly she started it again afterwards. So
that's what got me. It's like it burst into flame. And then the next time, I'm like, you drove it more?
Wait, there's something missing here, right?
Yeah. It was a LeBaron, and anyway, you can't kill it with fire.
Yeah, that's true.
That's so true. That's fantastic. So shall we wrap the episode with our Grand Trivia Auto questions?
Yes.
All right. So my two questions were, should we do these one at a time or shall I ask them both? And let's just do them one at a time.
One at a time.
Okay. So the first question was, what was the last Ferrari automobile personally approved by Enzo Ferrari? Was it the 333 SP? Was it a 288 GTO? Was it an F40? Or was it a 412 Ti? I'm going to call on Jim last because I'm thinking he knows the answer to this question. Dave, you go first.
I have absolutely no clue on this one. I'm going to go with the 280 GTO because I don't have Ben here to, you know, text.
Don, what do you think?
Yeah, this, I don't know the life of Enzo, so I don't really know, all that. I'm going to guess the F40.
You're going to guess the F40? All right. Jim, do you have the answer?
No, I don't. I'm gonna give a guess, which is gonna be the F40.
Okay. In fact, the answer is as the successor to the 288 GTO, the F40 was designed to celebrate Ferrari's 40th anniversary. At the time, it was Ferrari's fastest, most powerful, and most expensive car. So it was the F40. Well done.
Was it 1988 then?
I don't have a date on that. Whatever.
Because if it was 48 that they were, I mean, that would make sense in 88.
That makes sense. Yeah.
The F40 would, I think it came out in 88 or 89.
Right.
And they ran all the way through till about 91.
Well, the timeline's about right. Yeah. So that must be it.
So I was spitballing it, but numbers that worked. Yay, Jim.
All right. Me. Question number two, what was the original sales price of a new Ferrari 250 GTO in the United States? We'll go in the same order. What was the original sales price? Was it $18,000, $1,800, $8,000, or $80,000? Dave, what do you think?
I'm going to go with $18,000.
You're going to go with $18,000. Don, what do you think?
I'm definitely going $18,000 just because of the year. The 1962. I mean,
1962. That was, you know, that would have been a hell of a take home pay.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Jim go next, and I'll give him another rationale. But
yeah, Jim, 18,000. What do you have this one, Jim?
It's $8,000.
It's $8,000.
Yeah.
So what were you going to say, Don? Did you have a rational?
I was thinking that made sense for the 1962 era. Okay. Yeah.
In fact, the answer is when the new GTO, when new, that GTO cost $18,000 in the United States, with buyers personally approved by Enzo Ferrari and his dealer for North America, Luigi. So,
and you know how much that car, if for, let's say that you current value, but like, you know, if you're talking about cost of living adjustment, that was worth $155,000.
Wow.
At the time. So wow. $18,000 is the equivalent of $155,000 now.
Amazing. So, yeah. I mean, I thought my original thought was with Jim. I thought it was going to be an $8,000 car, and I clearly am wrong if these people are correct.
I made that assumption based on the fact that I have a check that Luigi Canetti wrote to Ferrari for a 330 LMB. Which is kind of the successor to the 250 GTO. And they only made three or four LMBs. And that check that Canetti wrote to Ferrari was for $13,017. So I made the assumption that a 250 GTO would have been a little less.
Amazing. Yeah, that seems like solid logic to me. But no, the thing apparently cost $18,000. So we need more car trivia. So if anyone in our listening audience has any items of trivia that you think it would be fun to share, we would love to give you a shout out as we ask your trivia question to our usual crew. Let's see here, since we're editing. Is there anything else you guys can think of we need to touch on before we actually wrap out?
I'm thrilled we made it through an episode without you taking out some abusive comment on nuns.
No, I was a delight to talk to Jim. Come on.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jim, because we're really Ferrari is a great vehicle and one that, you know, I see it driving down the road and I'm like, oh, I would love to have one of those. Yeah.
Yeah, Jim.
Well, I appreciate you guys letting me come on. This has been a lot of fun. I was a little worried that you were going to stump me and that I wouldn't have answers. And this has been very easy and very, very fun. Well, I appreciate it.
I think it's safe to say that none of us really takes ourselves too seriously when it comes to this kind of thing. But again, very glad you could be our guest, and I'm certainly looking forward to part two.
Absolutely.
And to our listening audience, thank you for joining us and being part of the Thing About Cars family. Again, if you have a moment, your ratings on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you catch our program help us get more visible to other car lovers. And our goal is to hopefully one day get featured by Apple Podcasts as a new and up-and-coming car podcast. That would be a cool thing to see. In the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe out there. Looking forward to a good springtime. We will see you with another episode in about a week. Take care, everybody.
Long. Happy spring.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.